You're listening to TIP.
And one of the questions I love to ask older, wiser people is, you know, if you were 35, 40, 30, whatever it is, age, you know, what advice would you give yourself kind of 15, 20 years ago that would be most helpful to you today? And so I asked him that question and he stopped and he was like, well, that's an easy one.
Hey guys, in today's episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with Brent Beshore, the CEO of Permanent Equity, a private equity firm with a long-term holding period of 30 years that invests in family-owned businesses. You'll hear about Brent's conversion story and his journey from atheism to faith and how that has affected his life and career. You'll also learn what it was like for him to become more public with his beliefs, the books he recommends to skeptics, what his advice is to people looking to acquire a business, his views on buying versus starting a business, and a whole lot more. There are a handful of investors that have made a big impact on me on Twitter, and Brent is definitely one of those. This was a little different episode as we really focused on Brent's journey to faith and how that has affected his life and career for the better. I really found it fascinating, and I hope you guys do too. Without further delay, let's dive into today's episode with Brent Beshore.
Celebrating 10 years. You are listening to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network. Since 2014, we interviewed successful entrepreneurs, business leaders, and investors to help educate and inspire the millennial generation. Now for your host, Patrick Donnelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Millennial Investing Podcast. I'm your host today, Patrick Donnelly, and joining me in the studio today is Mr. Brent Beshore. Brent, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Patrick, for having me on. Appreciate it.
I've been really excited to have you on here. You've unknowingly been a pretty big influence on me. I shared before we started talking that I think your podcast with Chris Powers was the only time I've listened to a podcast and started crying as he was sharing some of his kind of faith journey, which we'll get into later with you. But I just wanted to start off, you had a post today on Twitter about a practice that you've done for the last year that I thought was really interesting, and I wanted to go into it. It was a wiser older man gave you this advice. Can you share a little bit about that and just go into it, what it was, what it is, and then what the outcome was for you?
I was with a group of men out in California, and it was kind of a small group of guys. I met this gentleman, his name's Todd Peterson. Todd actually used to kick in the NFL. Just a great guy. He's an entrepreneur. He's just like the consummate loving elder now, but he's not that old. I mean, he's in his 50s, like mid to late 50s at this point, but he's just like this kind, generous, loving guy. And so I got to develop a relationship with him in this sort of group environment. And then afterwards I said, hey, do you mind if I give you a call? I have a few questions I'd like to ask. He's like, sure. Yeah, no problem. So we hopped on the phone probably a couple of weeks later. And one of the questions I love to ask older, wiser people is, you know, if you were 35, 40, 30, whatever it is, age, you know, what advice would you give yourself kind of 15, 20 years ago that would be most helpful to you today? And so I asked him that question and he stopped and he was like, well, that's an easy one. I was like, great. He said, I'd read the Bible every day. First thing I do is get up in the morning and read the Bible. I was like, yeah, sure. I read the Bible too. And he's like, and then I do this exercise. Know, be, do. What should you know based on what you read? Who should you be based on what you read? And what should you do based on what you read? And he said it. And I kind of was like, yeah, great. Fantastic. Any other advice that you'd give me? And he was like, hey, did you not hear what I just told you? And he was super, I mean, he was very kind about it, but he was like, he's kind of a little bit like, I just told you the singular thing that if I could go back and tell myself earlier to start doing this, it would change everything. And I was like, really? Okay. It's really that impactful. And he was like, it's really that impactful. He's like, I do it. I exchange these with a handful of guys every day. And we've been doing it for a decade plus now. And it's changed all of our lives. And it's this unbelievable, both accountability and the intimacy that it creates in relationship with not only God, but with each other. And so I said, man, that's great. The next day I texted him. I said, okay, I tried to do it this morning and I feel like I'm stumbling through it. Could you send me yours? Anyway, he sent me his for 2 or 3 days. I replied back with one and then another. And we've been texting each other every day for the last over 2.5 years now. About a year ago, it was Easter. I felt compelled to just, it changed so much in my life. I mean, I can literally chart exactly when I started that and the trajectory of my life since then, 2.5 years ago. My marriage is almost infinitely better than it was 2.5 years ago. My sort of inner life, the transformation I've had with health, everything. And by the way, it's not like quote unquote magic in it is not that you're going to do this thing and it's, you know, it's going to transform. It's just that getting in the word every day and taking it seriously and developing a deeper and deeper relationship where you can focus on one thing, Jesus, it transforms everything around you. And so it's a practice. Look, church fathers going back for millennia now have advocated for practices, right? Sabbath, prayer, all these things, fasting. And so this is a practice that he has found and that he was passed down to him that I'm now passing down to other people. And so I send it now to 9 guys every morning. And I've been posting it to Twitter for the last year. I actually quit it today just because I wanted to give people a full year view. So the entire Bible in a year, full year view of what does it look like to do it, to practice it for a year. That should be plenty of inspiration for people. And the whole idea was never for people to consume it, because that's not the point. The point is not to just read another sort of Bible study from somebody else. The point is to put it into practice. And so my hope is actually by ending it, that I encourage people, whoever were kind of lurking in the shadows and reading it and, you know, sort of enjoying it, which a bunch of people have now come out and said that they have. My encouragement to all of them is just get a partner, start exchanging it daily, hold each other accountable, and see for yourself.
I was one of those lurkers, and I really enjoyed it. It is a practice, like you said. It's not something to just read. I mean, it's great reading, and you can get a lot from it. But like you said, it's a practice that you need to actually do. And so you were using the one-year Bible. Is that what you've got it right there? One-year Bible. And then all of you, the 9 guys or whatever, would follow along. You'd have the daily reading, and that's what you would write on?
Yeah. So the one-year Bible, the one that I've been doing now, is a passage from Old Testament. So I'm in Deuteronomy now, and then passage from New Testament, Luke, and then a passage from Psalms, yeah, and a passage from Proverbs. And so it's every day. You get a little bit of taste of everything. And it's amazing, too, how, at least I found, you'll see common themes that I would never connect because of the way that you're reading them together. So it'll oftentimes be something from Deuteronomy, something from Luke, and something from Psalms will kind of all like have a connected theme through them. Sometimes it doesn't happen that way, but it's just whatever stands out, you know, right? So I'll go through it, I'll highlight, and I'll make notes. And then it's just whatever hits me. What should I know? Who should I be? What should I do? Write it down. It's not for, like I said, it's not for performance. It's not like God's happier with me or something because I did this. It's more of just being able to align my heart to reality, to the truth of who God is and who I am, which I forget often and need a lot of help with.
Yeah, we all do. So I know that you influenced David Perel quite a bit. It sounds like I read something that's all he reads now is the Bible. I mean, this is a guy that read widely and voraciously all kinds of stuff. Now he just focuses on the Bible. It sounds like you made a big influence on him.
Yeah, David's become, I mean, truly, he's like a godfather to my kids. He goes to Disney with us every year. He plays hide and go seek. In fact, we tried to convince him to move to Columbia because he could entertain our children. That's really the main purpose. But no, we love David. I think he's visited us, 5 or 6 times in the last year here in Columbia. My kids know him as Uncle David. But yeah, David interviewed me actually on his podcast. Boy, pushing probably 7 years ago now. And at the time, he grew up a secular Jew in San Francisco. He was living in New York at the early in of his career, didn't know what he wanted to do, hyper energetic. And so anyway, we had a great conversation. We hit it off like you and I are now on a podcast. And then it was probably 2 or 3 weeks after that, he said, "Hey, can I come visit you in Columbia?" Sure. Yeah, happy to have you. So we came out to Columbia and we sat down and, you know, I thought it was going to be what most people, when they visit me in Columbia, it's like, "Hey, how can you help me get rich or become successful in business?" Right. And we talked about that a little bit for like, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. He goes, "All right, here's the real reason why I'm here." I'm like, "Great. I didn't know there was an agenda. What's the real reason?" He goes, "You're the first person I've ever met who's like a professing Christian." And I was like, "Really? I'm the first person?" He's like, "You're the first person I've ever like known, like I've gotten to really interact with who's a professing Christian." He's like, "I don't get it. Like, can you tell me like who is Jesus and what is this whole thing about?" And so we talked about mostly faith stuff. And I mean, he was very challenging to me, right? I mean, if you know David, he is not taking any pat answer. He's going to challenge everything. And I loved it. And we had just hit it off. And it was like, there's no tension. There was no aggression or anything like that. It was just two people with very differing worldviews, very different perspectives on what was true, talking about truth. And we talked for 7 straight hours. And it was beautiful. And then this like really interesting thing happened. He started to kind of like, you know, we'd talk, I don't know, once every month or two. And he'd kind of say, oh, well, I was reading about this and this can't be true because of this, or I have a problem with this. I'm like, great, let's talk about it. So we talk about it and he kind of go away and research. And it was over the course of, like I said, like 6 years. And he had a lot of other influences other than me. But yeah, he came to faith last year, and it's been amazing to see his life and transformation.
That's awesome. I love conversion stories. I think they're absolutely fascinating. In college, I read, it was the Thomas Merton biography, The Seven Story Mountain. He was a Catholic monk, made a huge impact on me. At the same time, I was reading that Bible, the one-year Bible, and it just made a huge impact on me. I love these kind of conversion stories, like how somebody goes from leading this very worldly, decadent, materialistic life to then becoming, you know, in Thomas Merton's case, a Catholic monk in a very strict order. So I wanted to get back to like your conversion story. Like, you grew up pretty hardcore atheist. I think the search for truth was always there, it sounded like, for you. Like, you were deeply hungering for truth in college, it sounded like, probably even before that. But talk to me a little bit about that, like this hunger for truth, trying to figure out like what was going on here and figure things out.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember I was 9 years old when I told my mom I didn't believe in God. And we went to church, you know, half the Sundays growing up. We went to a PCUSA church in Joplin, Missouri. Everyone kind of was you're in the Bible Belt there, right? It's like the cultural Christianity's in the water. But I didn't get it. You know, I'm not going to blame anybody. I mean, we had a wonderful pastor. His name's Bill Christman growing up. I set up a meeting. I can remember, I told my mom, hey, I need you to drive me to the church. I was like 14, probably maybe 15. And because I'd set up a meeting with the head pastor at the church, unbeknownst to my parents. You can imagine how terrifying I was as to raise me. You know, I just do stuff like that. My mom's like, you know, hey, is everything okay? Like, you know, I'm driving you to the church to meet with the pastor. Like, everything all right? You know, like, you know, what's going on? And I said, no, I have a whole bunch of faith questions. And so I had already determined at that point that I didn't believe in God. I didn't want kind of anything to do with it. The thing that I thought being a Christian was, is honestly what I see a lot of people professing today who call themselves Christians. And it was just never interesting to me, which was there's a set of rules. And if you obey these rules, then you get favor in this life and the next. In order to be a good person, you need to follow the rules. I'm not a rule follower. Like, that's never been attractive to me. I hate rules. I hate structure. That's just not my thing at all. And so I definitely rebelled against that. I rejected what I thought was Christianity, what I thought was following Jesus, and became, yeah, like I said, an atheist. So I met with Bill Christman, the pastor. He was super kind and generous to me, sat with me for over an hour. And, you know, I pounded him with question after question. At that point, like, this is what I have so much empathy for people who think Christians are idiots, who even would listen to this and think that we're morons. Believe me, I was there. Like, I was there. But yeah, I left that meeting. I left the rest of high school, into college, into my 20s. And I just kind of started drifting more and more towards what I would call like hyper-rationalism, towards, you know, new atheism, Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, that type of, you know, especially at that time, that was kind of the heyday for the new atheist crew. And they were very bombastically aggressive towards anybody of faith, including Christians. Weirdly enough, Dawkins now calls himself a cultural Christian. Weirdest thing I've ever heard. Anyway, there's a whole transformation going on with a bunch of these guys now. But back then, they were all, you know, if you believed in God, the sky fairy, all this stuff. So I adopted a lot of that language. And ultimately, what I grew up kind of thinking I knew, and the way I thought the world worked, was that the more wealth and fame and power you could accrue, that would make up for everything. You could exert control, people would honor you, you could, you know, you'd live a good life with that. And so really the quest in my 20s was to accumulate as much as I could. And, you know, if I was God, I would have smited me, right? Like I would have taken everything away. I would have said, look, look at that guy. That guy thinks he has it all figured out. He's arrogant. He's condescending. I'd take it all away from him. I'm not God, thankfully. And the God who I now follow and worship is this loving, kind, generous, winsome God who instead of taking everything away and smiting me, gave me more than I could ever dream and hope for. And so I ended my 20s wealthier than I ever thought I'd be, more successful. We're 28th on the Inc. 500, invited to the White House to advise Obama on entrepreneurship policy. You know, started winning other awards, had a thriving business, my beautiful wife who loved me, and it all tasted like crap. All tasted like crap. I mean, the best bottles of wine. I told my wife I didn't love her. I tried to retire and play golf for a while. That felt terrible. I'd wake up every day with sweaty palms, anxious. And so it was just, I was a mess. And it was about that time. In fact, I met a guy at the Inc. 500 conference in 2009, 2010. Maybe it was 2010 by the time it happened. So we were on the 2009 Inc. 500. And his name is John Garrett. He's still a dear friend of mine today. And I can remember him. I met him there and we were out. And he's a big Texan. He's a Christian. He's like, great personality. He's like, Brent, where do you stand with the Lord? And I'm like, what do you mean? Where do I stand with the Lord? Like, what are you talking about? You believe that stuff? I started talking with him. I started learning more from him. He is this effervescent personality, relaxed, rested, loving, kind, loves his wife, loves his kids, great relationship with his coworkers. I'm like, wait a minute, what do you have that I don't? Because you clearly have something. And sure enough, God started surrounding me with these people. They had something I didn't have. There was an aroma to their lives that I didn't have. And I didn't see it in any of the lives of the people who I admired, frankly, who were super successful. That started the journey of God surrounding me. And they started, giving me books and correcting my condescending personality, my lack of humility, my pride. And over time, I started really diving deep. So, behind me, there's this whole, these are all faith-based books. I just read and read and read. I didn't get to the bottom of it. And so, I took seminary classes. I bought all the books that you could possibly buy on the historicity of the resurrection. I actually just got this monster. Hold on, let me see this book here. I haven't started reading it yet, but just got this baby on the resurrection. It's like a murder weapon. But I love to read stuff like this because it's such a bolster to my faith of, hey, if I'm going to believe something, right? And this is the thing that I admire atheists actually far more than I do most agnostics, because at least atheists are going to say, hey, here's where I stand and here's what I believe. And I think you're wrong. And it's like, great, now back it up. And that's when push came to shove with me, I was that way when I was an atheist. And a lot of people came to me and said, hey, back it up. And I couldn't back it up. Like, I hadn't thought about a lot of the questions, even though I took philosophy classes and religion classes in college at a great university. I had just not thought about a lot of the consequences of my faith, or my lack of faith, if you want to call it that. And so slowly but surely, I started reading more. And then ultimately, it doesn't matter how much knowledge you have, ultimately you have to surrender, right? And so there was a moment where I was like, I believe this is true. I believe that this is real. And my life's never been the same. I mean, it's been a clunky, difficult, not as far down the path journey as I thought I'd be at this point in terms of change, but there's been some miraculous change too. So just God's timing is perfect.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host. Hey guys, the Range Rover Sport leads by example. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capability, and combines assertive on-road performance with the signature Range Rover refinement that you'd expect. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, and redefines sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, which offer new levels of comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit-like driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can also enjoy a dynamic drive in total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com. Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
I've got a mentor who says, you know, the whole idea of like, it's the rich man getting into the kingdom of heaven. It's more difficult, you know, than through an eye of the needle. He actually changes it. He's like, it's actually the intellectuals that have, it's the intellectuals that are thought, you know, thinking and doubting and cynical that have the difficulty getting in. You know, like it's really difficult for heady people. But I think if you do the work, like you've given the example I've heard in the past of like C.S. Lewis, Mortimer Adler, what's the guy's name, the Chicago Tribune writer, Lee Strobel, who wrote The Case for Christ. Basically, you know, these were all atheists, but actually dove in to disprove Christianity and actually ended up becoming believers, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, G.K. Chesterton has a great quote on this. He's like, a young atheist can never be too careful what he reads, for he might convert to the faith, right? I mean, it's like this idea, I think there's a lot of people, and I certainly had this idea that it's like, Christians were the uneducated ones. They were the ones who were not thoughtful. And by the way, there's a lot of Christians who I've met who, you know, they grew up in the faith. It's a faith that they adopted, that they didn't really like, they didn't grind through and work through. And some of them truly are believers and have been given this amazing faith, which is great. But some of them are not. Some of them, when they get tested and tried, I mean, this is the seed being scattered on different types of soil, right? It can easily be choked out. And I think this is where you see a lot of people who all of a sudden, even some pastors who are all of a sudden like, oh, I read this argument against whatever part of the faith is, and it totally rocked my world. And I realize I don't believe anymore. And it's like, well, no, what you had before then was untested. And I think that's one of the things that I'm really grateful for is because I came to faith as an adult and I wanted nothing to do with it. Like, I feel like that there's really, I haven't heard anything, and I would love if there's anybody who listens to this who wants to provide a challenge. I mean, I've read hundreds of books from atheists about the faith and about their critiques of the faith, and I feel pretty comfortable now that there's nothing that I could know, and I've seen way too much at this point. Like my relationship with God, like I've seen miracles, I've seen things happen that I have no way to explain them otherwise. But like that's where I feel like that rooted faith, that where the reliance upon, the trust in, it's not this like wishy-washy, oh, I guess I'm just going to comfort myself and have faith. That I think I thought when I was an atheist that that's what being a Christian was. It was like, well, hope things work out, you know, Pascal's wager, maybe a lot of people kind of lean on that, which by the way, I think Pascal is incredible. And I think Pascal's wager is a great technique to get people's attention. But like true faith is not just being like, well, I'm going to take in a holy insurance policy, right? It is a daily walk of dying to self, of reliance upon the Lord. And the fruit that it produces is incredible. It's unlike anything else. The love that I experience now, like I don't think I knew what love was until I became a believer. Because I had to experience the love of God. If I hadn't experienced the love of God, like you can only give what you already have. Like I didn't love my wife in the same way before I was a believer. So anyway, just beautiful. I just rambled on, but it's beautiful.
No, I love it. I love to hear it. It just sounds like it was a slow progression of reading, being surrounded by believers. I like John Mark Comer, I think is the guy's name, who he calls himself an apprentice to Christ. And I like to think of it that way, just like you are apprenticing to this guy that has influenced the world more than anybody else. You know, I mean, you've made this point about like Abraham Lincoln studied Christ, Einstein studied Christ, Napoleon studied Christ. It's like there's a reason that we should probably delve into who he was. And, you know, it's the C.S. Lewis idea of like he was either a liar, a lunatic, or he was what he said he was, or the Lord, right?
That's correct. I challenge people if I say, hey, have you ever studied Jesus? And they're like, no, I've never studied Jesus. It's like, well, that's dumb. They're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, who do you study? And they're like, oh, I study all these greats in business. And I study all the, and I'm like, well, do you know who they studied? They studied Jesus. And I was like, and by the way, even if you put his divinity aside, right? Like, let's just put that completely aside. Let's just say objectively, he's the greatest leader in the history of the world. He has the most followers in the history of the world. Wouldn't you want to know how he did it? Like, if you want followers of your own, if you want to build your own quote unquote brand, or if you want to lead people, he's the greatest leader. So why wouldn't you're going to study the leader who studied the leader that's actually the best leader? Why wouldn't you just go directly to the source and study the leader? And oftentimes when I get people kind of quartered like that, you know, it's usually at a dinner or something like that. People are like, all right, fine, I'll study Jesus. And I'm like, great. It's amazing what happens.
Yeah, that was my experience. I completely discounted Christianity right off the bat and explored all these other wisdom traditions in depth. But it wasn't until much
later. And they have a lot of wisdom.
Oh, they do, for sure. For sure.
And they have a lot of wisdom.
Can impact your life. Absolutely. Quite a bit. But it wasn't until later that I really got back into like reading and studying the Bible. And I like what like guys like Thomas Jefferson and Kevin Kelly. I don't know if you're familiar with Kevin Kelly, the guy that Wired magazine and Tim Ferriss interviewed him. Fascinating guy. He just read the red of what Jesus said. You can like condense the study, you know, and read what Jesus said and study that as an exercise. And I think that's great to challenge people that way. And I wanted to ask you though, like as you went through this kind of super gray nihilistic period of your life, and then you make this transition towards opening up towards studying the Bible and being surrounded by Christians, it sounded like that was a slow process. Once you made that transition, did it take like a back seat, and did it become more difficult? I think you asked Chris Powers that somehow did Christianity make you less of an effective business person or entrepreneur?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, to be honest, when I surrendered my life and surrendered, including the businesses, to the Lord and said, hey, all I have and all I am is yours. I mean, that's what's required. That's real faith, right? The Lord, it's his in the beginning, right? Like if you're a trillionaire and you gave everything away, you've given nothing to the Lord. I mean, it's all the Lord's anyway. But it's interesting. God gives us free will for a reason, because without free will, there was no love. Love has to be able to choose. And so once I chose to surrender, once I gave those things to God, the business has exploded. The businesses have done far better. And it's interesting because I've had the pleasure of having dinner with quite a few successful, famous people, billionaires. And one of my favorite meals I've ever shared is with the Green family, with David Green and his sons in Oklahoma City. And I remember asking David this exact thing. I said, David, like, Hobby Lobby is this monster organization. Put the politics aside, put what people think aside. You know, they're easy to lambast for some of their views. I'm just put all that aside. Just take for a second. This is a family that has deep convictions, loves the Lord, and that puts their money where their mouth is. They give away an unbelievable amount of money to support organizations that are helping the poor, the disenfranchised, women, children, orphans, the foreigner, all around the world. It's incredible. They take 50% of the cash flow of Hobby Lobby. And I'm not giving away anything that I think is confidential. They've written publicly about this. And now the entire Hobby Lobby organization is actually in a trust. They've given it all away. In fact, David wrote a book called Giving It All Away and Getting It All Back Again, which is just a beautiful kind of imagery of this. But politics aside, if you just look at what they do, I asked David, I said, how do you compete? It's a highly competitive thing that they're doing. I mean, they're brick and mortar retail. And I said, how did that work? I mean, you're giving 50% of your profits away. Like, that's 50% less to reinvest. That's 50%. I mean, that's a big deal. And he said, yeah, we have double the margins of everyone else. And I was like, wait, what? And he said, yeah, we have double the margins. And I remember this was probably, oh gosh, 6 or 7 years ago when I heard this. And I said, when did your margins double? And he was like, they doubled the year that we gave it all away to the Lord. And I was like, your margins doubled. And he said, yeah, the year, literally, that we decided to give 50% away, our margin doubled. So we actually had no net impact to the reinvestment of the business. And it's been that way ever since. And we have doubled the margins of all of our competitors. And I said, how is that? And he's like, we don't know. He's like, we have things that we do differently. We've got about 10 or 12 things that we know that we do differently than everyone else. We don't know which ones do what, and we don't know how the Lord works in this, but somehow the Lord provides, and the Lord honors the fact that he knows that it's his business. It's not our business. He knows that we need the resources to be able to accomplish certain things on behalf of the kingdom. And so he's blessed us. And I remember thinking to myself, I remember like, yeah, that is crazy. And sure enough, when I started, and in fact, this is still a process I'm actively doing. It's like, the more that I have surrendered, the more that I've said, hey, this is not about building my kingdom, about my gain, about trying to be the most, you know, the wealthiest person, or however, you know, whatever you want to say, the most famous or the most powerful or most well-respected. The more that I can just say, hey, look, all of life's a gift. I'm not trying to gain anything. There's nothing that I can lose. I'm just going to try to hold it with open hands, which, by the way, I fail daily at doing. It's amazing how quickly your hands close when you take your eye off Jesus. But I'm telling you, the way that the business is just exploded. I mean, the idea for the funds, the partnership with our investors, all of those things happened within a reasonable time right after I came to faith, and that it really solidified, and I really started to surrender the business side, which that was a progression too. Like, it was not obvious to me in the beginning when I gave myself and my life over. It's just weird. It's like a muscle, like anything else. You've got to develop a taste for what does it feel to be surrendered and what does it feel to be unsurrendered, to even understand what it is to give. And so it took me a while to give the businesses and money. And I mean, I used to be obsessed. I could tell you down to the dollar what my cash balances were. I could tell you what our rates of return were. I could care, you know, all that stuff. And the more that I open up my hands, the more I release that, the more God multiplies. And you don't do it again. This is where you get into prosperity gospel garbage. I'm not saying you give it away so that you get your triple portion or whatever kind of language that usually happens, but that's not the purpose. If you do it for the wrong reasons, like, God wants our heart. So if you give with a heart posture of trying to get it, God's not going to honor that. It's not going to work. God just wants our heart. And so, yes, the business, I mean, has there been consequences that have been negative for the business that I'm a sort of an out Christian? Absolutely. Are there people who haven't sold to us, the business where the business of buying other businesses, who haven't sold with us? Absolutely. Are there people who have invested with us because they think I'm an idiot because I'm a Christian? Absolutely. But we also have a lot of people who aren't Christians, who are sellers to us and who are investors with us. And I love it because Jesus collided with the world. Like, Jesus didn't isolate himself with the religious elites. It was the exact opposite. So my whole view is, you don't have to be a Christian to invest with us. You don't have to be a Christian to be hired by us. You don't have to be a Christian to work with us. Like, we want all people. Now, we agree on certain values, but you don't have to be a Christian to be in relationship with me. That'd be the anti-Jesus thing.
Was it difficult for you to become public with your beliefs? Like, you've really put yourself out there, and I really admire people like you and people like John Marsh that we talked about earlier that are very open about their beliefs, and you're going to take shots. So I just wanted to hear, like, how that has been for you, that being as open as you are and transparent and vulnerable. It's hard to do. I find it incredibly hard to do.
I had a lot of trepidation. Yeah, a mentor of mine and senior pastor at church, Dave Cover, who I've had a long-standing relationship. He was one of the people who helped bring me to faith originally. I remember having long conversations with him about being more known publicly as a Christian. And I remember thinking to myself, like, gosh, people are not going to like me. If anything, I have a tendency to want to people please. And so I was like, oh man, this grates against all of my people pleasing. And ultimately I said, look, either I believe or I don't. Either I'm going to be authentically me or I'm not. And if I'm going to be authentically me, if somebody asks me a question, I want to answer them truthfully. And if the true answer is because of this or that in the Bible, or because this is the way my belief system works, let the chips fall where they may. And I'm just going to trust that the Lord has me and will keep me and is my refuge. You know, it's interesting is the shots that I take are actually the best conversation starters. I've developed so many great relationships with people who have said something negative or condescending towards me in sort of a public setting that I've been professing my faith. And they start the best conversations. And by the way, it's not like they're like, you know, ultimately convert to following Jesus. Or some have, but like many of them, it's like we're just friendly and we care about each other. And they think that I'm wrong and I think they're wrong. And that's okay. We can be wrong and still care for each other. The people who actually I probably struggle with the most publicly are the Christians that have a very different form of professing Christians, a very different form of belief than I do, and who dogpile on. You know, oftentimes when I'll say something on Twitter, you know, about faith, you know, you'll have people saying, oh, you're an idiot, you're wrong, blah, 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 and all this stuff. And my answer to them is like, I totally get it because I said the same stuff about people. As an ardent atheist, I was also being bombastic about it. The people that are really struggling with this, the people who are like, well, actually, yes, and here's this crazy thing that I'm like, whoa, I don't believe that. But they're like trying to be on my side and trying to like go at people. And I'm like, I'm having to like simmer them down. And anyway, so I don't mind when people are opposed to me. It gives me anxiety when people who believe different things than me, who profess, and it's really hard for me outside. I mean, it's one of the things I talked about with David Perel. Like, he was like, people will say that they're Christians and they don't believe in the divinity of Jesus. They'll say that they're Christians and they haven't been to church in 5 years. They'll say they're Christians and, you know, I mean, these are all the cultural Christians. You know, Christianity's been now identified with, you know, Republican politics. Like, it's all this other stuff. And by the way, shocker, people have been trying to use religion and tried to use Jesus to for their own ends since the beginning, right? I mean, this is nothing new. The problem is from the outside looking in, when you talk to somebody who's like, Christians are hateful, spiteful people, I'm like, I've never met somebody who has surrendered their life to the Lord, who is seeking humility on a daily basis, seeking to die to themselves, seeking to serve others, seeking to love the God with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength, love their neighbor as themselves, who is hateful. I've literally never met. Now, can we all have moments of anger and all stuff? But I've never met somebody who's a like quote unquote horrible person. Like, I've never met them. Now, I've met plenty of people who profess Christianity, who are people who I can't see Jesus' work in their life at all. And then you dig deeper and you ask them, well, okay, when was the last time you read the Bible? When was the last time you prayed? When was the last time you went to church? When was the last time, like, what do you actually believe? Well, it turns out they don't believe Jesus as Lord. They don't surrender to him as king. They don't read their Bible. They don't go to church. They don't pray. And it's like, why do you say you're a Christian? Oh, because I vote Republican. And that doesn't make somebody a follower of Jesus. As you said, John Mark Comer, and I just got finished reading his book. I actually recommend it on Easter called Practicing the Way, and especially when you pair it with Dallas Willard's book, Discipline of the Spirit, or Spirit of Discipline, excuse me. Amazing combination. But I just, you know, as you said, he's like, following Jesus is about practice. It's about apprenticing under him. It's about learning a way of life that gives freedom. I mean, that is what being a Christian is. It's not even about, I mean, yes, we go to church because we're called to be a body of Christ. We're called to be united. We're called to be in community. But it's not like God's like, oh, well, you check that box. Great. You know, you went to church. Okay, now you're a Christian. Like, that's not being Christian. There's plenty of people who go to church who aren't Christians.
If there's somebody listening to this and they're on the fence, they've been, you know, struggling with issues of faith and things like that. Aside from the Bible, is there like, do you have like a couple go-to books that you recommend to people that you're like, read this and then get back with me?
Yeah, it's so interesting. It really depends on where they are. So there's categories of people I've learned as I've kind of, you know, talked to people about this, and people ask me a lot of questions about my faith background, my faith journey. And there's kind of a group of people who grew up in the faith and who just kind of faded away from the faith is what I would say, right? So just kind of like they got busy, the cares of the world choked them out. And they just kind of, you know, now they're in their mid 30s, maybe in their 40s. And they're, you know, they're like, I want my kids to go to church. I want my kids to be good people. I kind of followed away. I still believe there's God, but I haven't prayed much in the last long time, you know, whatever it might be. For those people, you don't need to convince them that there's a God. You don't need to convince them of they need to break their worldview and that there's, you know, a supernatural world to this. And, you know, the world is actually really upside down. I think all that stuff, like, you don't need to tell that for them. They need to understand sort of what does it mean to really follow and practice following Jesus, and what is the fruit of that? And so books like Practicing the Way, books like Spirit of the Disciplines, those are really good books for kind of getting people reignited. Another book that he's become a dear friend of mine, his name's David Gibson. He wrote a book called Living Life Backward. That's the best meditation on Ecclesiastes I've ever read. It just has so much wisdom, and it's like the smelling salts of life. That's another book that I really try to... Oh, there you go.
There it is.
Yeah, look at you.
It's a good
right there. So trying to get people just reconnected to feel, you know, what does it feel like to be back in relationship with God, right? God's always been there. God's not distant. If God's distant, you're the reason. But there's another group of people, and I would say, you know, I didn't have this experience, so I have to be careful with how I speak about this, who have been hurt by the church. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people who fit in this category. And man, my heart goes out. The stories I've heard are just heartbreaking. I can't imagine the pain and suffering of somebody who put their trust and faith in people who were leading them spiritually, who abused them, either physically, sexually, emotionally. You know, spiritual abuse is a real thing. Now, here's the problem. I told somebody the other day, that, you know, Gandhi's quote, he said, I love Jesus. I really like Jesus. I just don't like people who follow him. And I would say, I think it was Gandhi who said that. Christians are a terrible representation of Christ. You and me included. Like, we are deeply flawed. I mean, we believe as part of our core belief system that we are depraved in many ways, that if left unredeemed, that we are capable of terrible things. And I think that that's obvious in this world, right? I mean, it doesn't take long. Read the news. The sin is about the only thing that we can all agree on. There's something terribly broken about this world. And that doesn't stop when you enter a church or you enter a religious organization. And unfortunately, people are messy. And when you get people together, whether they are followers of Jesus or not, there's going to be messiness. And so with people who have been hurt by the church, you know, there's some books about, and there's all different kinds of lines of reasoning. Does the church encourage certain types of abuse? Does the church encourage this or that? And my answer is, I think you can go back and read through the history that it is not that anything that Jesus said, it is not anything that's biblical that encourages abuse of any type. It is fallen people doing fallen things. And unfortunately, they were a victim of fallenness and brokenness of this world. And the problem is always sin, and the answer is always Jesus. And so there's a whole line of books. There's a great book called Questioning Christianity. Let's see if I can find it. Let's see up here. Or Confronting Christianity. He's a wonderful author. Anyway, Confronting Christianity. Yeah, McLaughlin. So she has, let's see here. I'm going to actually read through here. Rebecca is her first name. And so, yeah, so she's a great book, came out a little while ago, so the chapters are we better off without religion? Doesn't Christianity crutch diversity? How can one say that there's only one true faith? Does a religion hinder morality? Does a religion cause violence? How can you take the Bible literally? Hasn't science disproved Christianity? Doesn't Christianity denigrate women? Isn't Christianity homophobic? Doesn't the Bible condone slavery? How could a loving God allow so much suffering? And how could a loving God send people to hell? Those are hard questions. Boom, right? So this isn't like another one of those books that I think she does a really great job of approaching them. And, you know, pretty, I mean, there's a lot more deeper reading on each one of those subjects.
Is she,
Is
she a professor in Boston or somewhere? Do you know her background?
Yeah.
Okay. I saw her speak this past summer. Yeah. She spoke in Columbus and I got the chance to see her. She was amazing.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, we had her when she spoke in Columbia as well. We had her for dinner at my house, threw a little dinner party, and just really enjoyed getting to know her. My point is, for somebody who's coming out of a broken relationship with the church, quote unquote, or, I mean, this is also a good book for some people who have their only exposure, like David Perel, to Christianity was watching Netflix, right? And seeing some, you know, KKK, Lily White church service, and then people go out and, you know, murder black people or whatever the depiction is. You know, there's a lot of these common misconceptions. And by the way, I had all of these, like, I thought a lot of those things were true. Like a lot of those questions, I would have come down the other side. So it took me a long time to really dig deep and to understand, okay, wait a minute. The Bible is not prescriptive in many ways. It's descriptive. So in the Old Testament, when it talks about all these people having lots of wives and terrible abuse and murder and rape. I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff. It's not that the Bible's saying, hey, you should go do these things. In fact, the exact opposite. It's saying, this is just what happened. And by the way, here's the consequences of what happened. And they're terrible consequences because all those things go against the grain of how the Lord created the universe. So anyway, there's a lot of misconceptions. My point is it depends on if somebody's listening to this and they came out of, look, I don't think there's a God. I think science is the ultimate arbiter of truth. There's a whole line of things. You know, I'd recommend a lot of Keller's books. He has two in particular. Let's see if I can grab Making Sense of God and Every Good Endeavor back here. See if I can grab them here real quick. So Making Sense of God.
He's got a good one on marriage too.
Oh my gosh. I'm actually reading his marriage. We have a 20s group that we're reading his marriage book with right now. So these two books, Making Sense of God and Every Good Endeavor, or not Every Good Endeavor, shoot, that's the business one. Making Sense of God and The Reason for God is the other one that's really good, somewhere back here. These are really impactful for me as an atheist to read about how much faith it takes to be an atheist, let's put it that way. And I never framed it that way, but that's honestly what these books provided. And so, yeah, there's a lot of books. Honestly, my DMs are open. I get questions all the time on Twitter about book recommendations and podcasts to listen to and kind of just to help point people in the right direction. If anybody's listening to this and has a question, I'd be happy. Just DM me. I'd be happy to connect.
I've got a guy that's in my Bible study that will listen to some of our podcasts. We study billionaires as our kind of flagship podcast, and it's all about studying Buffett and Munger. And he was just asking me, he's like, it seems like Buffett and Munger are Christians. I don't know that they ever have said that publicly. You know, Charlie unfortunately passed away, you know, recently, but you've had the chance to have dinner with or a meal with both of them, break bread with both of them. I am really interested to hear your thoughts on like that experience for sure. But like, were they just steeped in like Midwestern Christian values and it's just a, you know, part of just who they are, or were they practicing Christians?
Hey, look, I don't know ultimately where anybody stands. I can tell you when I had meals with them, I actually asked them both this question and neither of them were professing Christians at that time. So that was 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. And so, but yeah, look, I mean, I think there's the world we live in is a Christian world. The West is a Christian world. Like we have a world that's made around Christian values, whether or not you believe in Jesus or not, whether or not you think it's true and right. I mean, we are swimming in Christian waters. And so, yeah, a lot of the ideas, I mean, they've won out because they're true. And so why do we say that people have dignity? Because we're made in the image of God. Like, again, a lot of my atheist friends would argue that there's nothing special about humans. Like we are no different than animals. They would just say look, Scott Adams calls us moist robots. I mean, there's this idea. I mean, truly, and like, I don't know how you get to meaning and beauty and morality outside of faith. And that's what, honestly, one of the things that scared me when I first started exploring these, and I was really offended, like angry when I was an atheist and I was given some of these books, I started reading through them and I'd be challenged with that. They'd be saying, look, there is no morality unless there's a moral lawgiver. Like, where does morality come from? If you say that it just comes from you and I agreeing on what is moral, well, that's fine, but there's nothing sacrosanct about it. There's nothing, it's just me and you having a social contract, right? So this is actually, you know, in political theory, it's called social contract theory. It's just, look, we have a social contract and you and I agree that like murdering people just doesn't work very well for our society. That doesn't mean it's wrong. So like when you judge somebody or we say, oh my gosh, what a horrible person. Like there's no oughts, there's no shoulds. Like we're just random co-location of atoms. We randomly developed out of goo, right? And we're headed towards nothingness. We came out of nothingness. There's no actual underpinnings of morality. It's just what we create. We create meaning. There's actually no ultimate meaning. We just create meaning. That's fine. But that means there's no ultimate beauty, right? There's all these things that are these big challenges. And so what I would say is that getting back to Buffett and Munger, I mean, I share a lot of values with both of them. I think they are incredibly wise in many ways. But look, I mean, Munger's book that was written about is called Worldly Wisdom, right? I mean, the book is about worldly wisdom. And I think that there's this idea of common grace, like God lets the rain and the sun come on the believers and the unbelievers alike, right? There's this idea that God showers down blessings. We have 10,000 blessings every day that we don't even realize. Wait until your toe hurts to realize you have a toe. Most of the mornings I don't wake up and say, man, thankfully, my toe works today, right? But I guarantee you have a huge problem with your toe and you're going to be aware of your toe. So, you know, I would say is for both those guys, they were deeply steeped in Christian values. I think both of them came out of families that were faith-driven, but neither of them, I think, professed the faith.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey, everyone. It's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Everything seems to be more expensive these days. I've noticed this at my own businesses that I've run. You'd be wise to find proven ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/MI. netsuite.com/MI. That's netsuite.com/MI.
All right, back to the show.
I want to kind of switch gears a little bit. I've got a buddy of mine who he's got a couple kids in college, and he's encouraging them to use an SBA loan, buy a business, use an SBA loan, and come right out of college firing, you know, with a business of their own. I know that you have done that. Like, that's kind of a little bit how you got your start, used an SBA loan. So can you talk to that, speak to like somebody who's young, who may be listening to this, who is interested in what you've done and wants to get started? Like, what would be some of the steps? What would you recommend? That kind of thing for a young person or middle-aged person who wants to do what you've done.
Yeah, so I got my start by, I started a business and then I ended up buying a sort of adjacent business with an SBA loan. And that's how, yeah, I mean, that was ultimately how that was kind of foundational, how I got started. It's all about risk reward. I mean, ultimately it comes down to, you know, if you're a believer, what do you feel God's calling you to do? You know, do you have peace about it? Do you, I pray about there's a, yeah, anyway, that we can talk about books and going down that path. But ultimately, if you decided that you want to get into business, you want to own a business, SBA can be a great route. It can be a higher interest rate. It's a 10-year fixed rate, which right now is pretty darn high. I haven't looked recently, but I think it's like 10 or 11%. That's nothing to sneeze at. That's a lot of interest you're going to be paying. And there are prepayment penalties, I think, associated with it. So it's not like it's a free lunch, right? I mean, it's real. And you personally guarantee it. So things go bad. And by the way, the visibility principle of like, you only see winners are the ones that raise their hand and say, look at me, I'm a winner. you know, I've had four people in the last year, maybe a little longer than a year, 18 months, who have reached out who have declared bankruptcy as a result of buying a business with an SBA loan. So, and there are a few people on Twitter who will talk about this, but most of the time it's, oh, it's free money. It's easy money. Look, you know, here's your interest rate. Here's your multiple you pay. You do the math on it. You get to keep the difference. And by the way, all that's true. I mean, look, if you buy a business for 3 to 5 times multiple on free cash flow, which is kind of the standard, what most small businesses go for, you're talking about what, a 33% to a 20% cash yield, starting yield. If it's true owner earnings, you know, stick to your bones, cash flow. You're paying 10, 11% in interest. You get to keep 10%. You get to keep 11%, right? I mean, like it's not complicated. The challenge is if you falter a little bit and the business goes down a little bit, you lose everything. Now, if you're right out of college and you don't have anything, I mean, the reality is the bankruptcy laws are there for a reason. And I mean, this is just, again, I'm just speaking to strict financial reality here. Nothing, you know, sort of no moral judgment one way or the other. But look, if you don't have much and you can convince a bank to do an SBA loan and you've got the ability to negotiate it and to run it and you feel good about it, and it just doesn't work out, you declare bankruptcy and you're 24, 25, you'll be fine. Like, you'll be fine, right? I mean, you know, I think it's a little more complicated when, and I've seen this sad scenario play out where, you know, you've got 2 or 3 kids and you're in your 30s and you've got a good job, but you haven't saved much and you take all of what you saved and you put it into an SBA loan and, you know, it turns out things are hard. And there's a reason, you know, most things are efficiently priced is how I would say it. I remember when I first got into buying small companies, you know, I was like, man, you could pay 3 times and like, this is incredible. Yeah. Except for when you buy decades of problems and that 3 times quickly diminishes and turns into 8 times, it can get pretty dicey quick. So I would say is just generally principle that I would have is from the time I started searching till the time that I bought a business, I'd budget 3 years of full-time work. 3 years of full-time work, because over those 3 years, you're going to see a lot of stuff. Your tastes are going to change. You're going to dodge a lot of bullets. And a lot of the seeds you plant in year one are going to start flowering in year three. And so from the time that, you know, you first get introduced to a business till the time you close, usually for smaller companies is at least 4, 5, 6 months, at least. So you got, if you got to back up from that and say, okay, look, I start searching day one. I start making phone calls. I start interacting with people who have access to these types of deals. I start calling potential sellers. It can take a long time. You got to get a lot in the pipeline. And by the way, something's going to come along early and you're going to say, ooh, that looks attractive enough. I might do that. And then you're going to dig in a little bit. It's going to get real hairy. It's going to, the more you dig in, the hairier it's going to get. Hopefully the deal falls apart and you don't get blind. Deal blindness is a real thing. And, yeah, it just takes time. And the joke in the private equity world is the deal has to die 3 times before you can close it. And it's usually pretty true. I mean, usually there's about 3 times where somebody freaks out, something happens, the deal's called off, and then you got to kind of regather. And by the way, sometimes it never happens where you close, but deals that close, you got to regather, you know, things, and it takes time. And if you have a time pressure and you're running out of money and you've got people who are breathing down your neck to do a deal, you just start getting incentives that are all off and wonky. And so it's complicated. I actually wrote a piece. It's on the Permanent Equity website called How to Buy Your First Smaller Company. Recommend people read it. I go through a lot of these questions on there about, you know, how should you think about financing? How should you think about geography? How should you think about industry? And then the funny thing is most people are like, oh, I succeeded. I bought a business. Oh, it's just the starting line. You worked your tail off for years to get to the starting line. Now you got to run the thing. That's really hard. All that to say, it sounds like I'm being down on it. I'm trying to be neutral on both sides. Like, I don't want anybody to listen to this and say, oh man, I'd never thought about buying a small business. It sounds super easy. I can get rich quick. Like, whoa, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm also not saying on the other side that there's not gold in the hills. Absolutely gold in the hills. You just got to be ready to mine for it. And it's going to be pretty hairy. And so as long as you go into eyes wide open, yeah, go for it.
So you've done both. You've started your own company. You've bought existing companies. Looking back on things, like for a young person, is there one avenue or another that you would recommend?
Yeah, it's all hard. I would say it's all hard. It depends on what you want to do. It depends on your skill set. Like if starting a fence builder from scratch is brutally difficult, and there's a reason why most fence builders are tiny, and there's a reason, I mean, but let me tell you, you'll learn a lot and you'll put less capital at risk. So I would say is starting a company puts more time at risk. Buying a company puts more capital at risk. So basically, the way to think about it is by buying something, you are buying a big chunk of time. Like if I wanted to build our portfolio that we have today, the portfolio that we built over, call it 15 years of doing this, it would take me hundreds of years to get them off the ground and to get them all up and going, right? So I've bought hundreds of years of progress in 15 years for a lot of capital, for $200 million of capital, right? Plus $1 million of capital that we've invested. Actually, maybe more than that now. But anyway, so that's the way to think about it is like, if you know exactly what you want to do and there's no one else that you can go buy, build it. If you know exactly what you want to do and somebody else is willing to sell it to you and you can take capital risk and exchange it for time risk and jump 15 years ahead, that's a good thing to think about doing as well.
Yeah, I guess it's just case dependent and people figure it out as they go along, right? I mean, you know, in your own case, it doesn't sound like you, there was no playbook, right? You didn't have this playbook that you were following. It's just like you figure stuff out as you go along.
Yeah. Well, and what most people don't, I mean, I don't talk about this publicly a lot, but just to be honest, like my line is like, it's not a straight line from like, oh, Brent started a business, then bought a business and then, you know, rocket ship, right? It's like a very squiggly, you know, I invested in real estate. We bought some things that haven't worked. We've had to shut down a company now. Like, you know, I invested in startups for a while, some very successfully, some, most of them bombed. Like I've kind of tasted and tried a lot of things. The thing that I knew that I could do, I thought better than a lot of people was offer a good long-term home to smaller companies and do it in the right way. That's what I thought I could differentiate around. And that's what we've done. And yeah, you know, I'm really grateful for it. I've watched, maybe to back up, buying one business is brutally difficult. Buying a handful of businesses and having to step up out of that one business is like a lot harder than buying one business. And then the third tier, which we're kind of going through now, is just build an organization that can repeatedly search for, negotiate, document, close, and operate businesses at scale. You know, balancing capital, balancing opportunities, balancing talent is a heck of a lot harder than the second level. It's just a heck of a lot harder than the first level. And the first level is brutally difficult. So I've watched, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, I'm building a holdco. I'm like, fantastic. Where are you? And they're like, oh, I haven't acquired a business yet. I'm like, you should probably just try to buy one business. Like the best way to build a holdco is buy one business, operate that business successfully, get it under control, install great leadership, treat them really well, then try to go out and buy a second company. And then try to operate that really well and install leader. I mean, that's a, like, that's the steps that you have to go down. I don't understand it. If I had been given $50 or $100 million when I was 2 years into this, I would have lost all the money. I would have lost everything because I would have made the worst decisions. I would have thrown money around. I wouldn't have known what's important, what's not important. Like the going slow aspect, like if you ask me, like, what is the single thing that's probably enabled our success is that we were capital constrained to start. By being capital constrained to start and to have to scrap and claw and fight and learn and go slow, it then allowed us to like create all these systems, create the processes, create culture, like get everything gelled together to then go. And it, interesting, like look at Berkshire. Berkshire was tiny and Berkshire was, you know, no one knew who Berkshire was until, gosh, Buffett was 55, probably, maybe 60. Like that's like most people just don't understand, like, they look at somebody like a Buffett or Munger, since you mentioned them, and they say, oh, well, I want to build the next Berkshire. Great. They went at it. Berkshire is the result of compounding over like 70 years. Like it's 70 years of compounding. That in and of itself is just, it's hard to wrap your head around. It's not like you can build a Berkshire in 20 years. I mean, you know, you talk to like Mark Leonard, who built Constellation Software. Like Constellation was nothing for the longest time. And then all of a sudden compounding takes over and it's a rocket ship, right? But people don't realize that like that portion's a really long time. Like it was working, but it was nothing for a long time.
Brent, this has been a lot of fun. There's so much I didn't even get to touch on. We didn't get to talk about Main Street Summit that's coming up and Capital Camp and so many other things I wanted to ask you, but this has gone by really quickly. I really appreciate your time and just being sharing about your faith journey. It's super interesting to me. So I hope it's of value to somebody, one listener out there. It'll be worthwhile. And yeah, thank you, Brent. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Patrick. Happy to come back on anytime. That was a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, folks, that's all I had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you back here real soon.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on our episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.